of the protoplanetary disk that was present before planets were formed. The asteroid belt probably had far more mass initially, most of which was lost in the dynamic early days of the solar system. Jupiter scattered away many of the objects originally in this region before they could coalesce, which probably explains the absence of planets in the region. Because it lost so much material, although the belt has many hundreds of thousands of objects bigger than a kilometer, its total mass today is a mere 25th the mass of the Moon, with the single object Ceres containing a third of that amount. When Ceres's mass is combined with that of the next three largest asteroids, half the total is accounted for, with the rest carried by the millions of smaller objects. On top of the hundreds of thousands or perhaps a million asteroids more than a kilometer wide, the belt contains even more asteroids that are smaller. Although harder to see, the numbers increase rapidly at smaller sizes, with the rule of thumb being roughly 100 times more objects that are 10 times smaller. In the process of ejecting small planetesimals from the region of the asteroid belt, Jupiter might also have thrown some water-bearing objects to Earth. Though the origin of the Earth's water is poorly understood, these Jupiter-induced early impacts might have played some role in the Earth acquiring its abundant water supply, since water could initially more readily accumulate in sufficient amounts in the outer, colder parts of the solar system. Interestingly, soon, on geological scales, after the early bombardment episode ended, about 3.8 billion years ago, life began to emerge. Fortunately for its perpetuation, though smaller, less frequent impacts continue to this day, asteroids and comets don't pelt down on the planet at the dangerous rate they did early on. Like planets, the first asteroids to be discovered were assigned various symbols. By 1855, there were a couple of dozen. Many of their names had mythological origins, but more recent discoveries assigned those fanciful names, including popular culture icons such as James Bond and Cheshire Cat, and even the names of the discoverer's relatives. Looking at the symbols for the individual asteroids reminds me of looking at a tablet of hieroglyphics. As my collaborator said, they resemble the name given to the artist formerly known as Prince. The analogy is especially apt, since, like Prince himself, these objects now have more readily pronounceable names. Scientists in early times probably approached their discoveries in a mystified state not so different from that of the ancient Egyptians. This is not to say the ancients didn't try to find order, but the universe is a complex place in which time, dedication, and technology are essential to successfully sorting out the nature of the objects it contains. With only limited observational capacity, it is difficult to tell whether an object appears dimmer or brighter or larger or smaller because of its size, composition, or location. Only time and better measuring tools could lead to true scientific understanding. At the time the original planets were discovered, no one knew anything about asteroids. Asteroids, like planets, don't emit visible light. Planets, asteroids, and meteoroids are illuminated only by the light they reflect from the sun. Finding asteroids is more difficult, however, since they are so much smaller and therefore dimmer and harder to see. Comets have bright trailing tails, and shooting stars are relatively nearby and bright. Asteroids, on the other hand, have no readily apparent features, so discovering them was and is a challenge. Indeed, it took at least a couple of thousand years before people looking up realized that asteroids graced the firmament. Without extremely sensitive tools, the only way to find these dim objects was to stare for a very long time, though it also helps to know in advance where to look. The first attempts relied on this latter logic. Astronomers didn't really know the best target locations, but they used a heuristic law they thought would help guide them in their search. The Titius-Bode law that they employed seemed consistent with the location of the known planets and predicted the location of others. The discovery of Uranus in 1781, where the law said it should be, seemed like a major success. Even so, there was no true theory to justify the law, and in any event, the location of Neptune doesn't conform to what it predicts. Yet despite the arbitrariness of the suggested locations, the technique that was employed to search for planets, remember at the time no asteroid had yet been found, even with only 18th century technology, was robust. Observers compared sky charts on different nights and searched for objects whose location had changed. Nearby planets moved noticeably, whereas distant stars appeared to be fixed. Using this method, and guided by the Titius-Bode law, Giuseppe Piazzi, founder and director of the Palermo Observatory in Sicily and also a Catholic priest, discovered an object on New Year's Day of 1801 that orbited between Mars and Jupiter, and the mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss subsequently calculated its distance from the Earth. We now know that the object they had discovered, Ceres, was not a planet, but was instead the first asteroid to be found. It lies in what we now know to be the asteroid belt that is located between Mars and Jupiter. Following several subsequent such discoveries, the astronomer Sir William Herschel suggested a separate term, asteroid, for them. The name was derived from the Greek word asteroides, which means star-shaped, since they appear to be more point-like than planets. Ceres, which we now know to be nearly spherical and about 1,000 kilometers in diameter, was even more special than the other asteroids. It turned out to be the first dwarf planet to be discovered, too. Asteroids were only minimally understood until technology and the space program advanced to the point where many of these objects could be better observed. The remarkable and ongoing progress from researchers in this field has been stunning. As exciting as discovering asteroids can be, observing and exploring them is even better. The ongoing space program has designed several recent missions with this goal in mind. These more direct explorations will greatly improve on the earlier, less detailed observations that began in the 1970s when close-up images first revealed asteroids' irregular shapes. Other notable asteroid missions from the past include NEAR Shoemaker, the first dedicated asteroid probe, which in 2001 took photographs of and even landed on the asteroid Eros, the first near-Earth asteroid to be discovered. Japan's Hayabusa mission returned stony asteroid samples in 2010, and Japanese scientists recently launched the even more ambitious Hayabusa 2, which will land on an asteroid where it will deploy 3 rovers to collect more samples by the end of the decade. NASA is about to launch OSIRIS-REx, which should bring back samples of a carbonaceous asteroid. Even more prominent in recent news has been the European Rosetta spacecraft, which flew by and gathered detailed information about the asteroids Lutetia and Steins before its more famous and more recent comet rendezvous. NASA's spacecraft Dawn is making news these days, too. It has already visited Vesta and has now reached the dwarf planet Ceres. In the future, the ambitious asteroid mining operations that are currently under consideration, though not necessarily the most obvious route to economic gain, are likely to prospect many more asteroids as well. So too might the spacecrafts designed with an eye toward asteroid deflection that are currently in the works, such as the ambitious Asteroid Redirect Mission, ARM, which NASA is developing. The current American space program's focus on asteroids, the planet's less glamorous but often more accessible counterparts, will very likely teach us quite a bit about our solar system. Meteors, meteoroids, and meteorites. Let's now turn from asteroids to the even smaller objects known as meteoroids. The study of meteoroids is known by the awkward-sounding term meteoritics, and not meteorology, which probably would have been the more sensible-sounding name for the study of the small stony objects in the sky. But before astronomy could claim the term, which comes from the Greek meteorion, meaning high in the sky, and logos, the word for knowledge, weather studies had already usurped it. Unfortunately for today's terminology, the ancient Greeks thought that studies of the weather fit the bill for meteorology, the study of objects in the sky. The first standardized definition of meteoroid, devised only in 1961 by the International Astronomical Union, was a solid object moving in interplanetary space that was considerably smaller than an asteroid and considerably larger than an atom. Though more sensible than meteorology from an astronomical perspective, it is not very specific either. In 1995, 2 scientists suggested restricting the size to between 100 micrometers and 10 meters. But when asteroids smaller than 10 meters across were found, scientists at the Meteoritical Society suggested changing the size range to between 10 micrometers and 1 meter, about the size of the smallest asteroid ever observed. But this change never became official. I'll often use the term meteoroid fairly liberally for medium-sized objects in the sky, but will refer to objects that are even smaller by their more accurate names of micrometeoroids or cosmic dust. Like asteroids, meteoroids differ dramatically in their nature, probably as a result of their wildly varying origins in the solar system. Some are snowball-like objects, with densities only a quarter that of ice, while others are dense nickel and iron-rich rocks, while still others have more abundant carbon. Although colloquial use for the term meteor frequently includes the meteoroid or micrometeoroid that created it, the correct use of the word corresponds to the term's Greek root, which means suspended in the air, and refers only to what we see in the sky. A meteor is the visible streak of light that is produced when a meteoroid or a micrometeoroid enters the Earth's atmosphere. Despite this definition, most people, even reporters, incorrectly talk about meteors falling to Earth, as does the name of the universally declaimed 1979 film Meteor, which in fairness has its entertaining moments. Amusingly, like meteorology, the term meteor had an early definition connected to weather, originally encompassing any atmospheric phenomenon, such as hail or a typhoon. Winds were called aerial meteors. Rain, snow, and hail were called aqueous meteors. Light phenomena, such as rainbows and aurora, were called luminous meteors. And lightning and what we now call meteors were called igneous meteors. These terms are relics from a time when no one knew how high anything was, or that weather features had dramatically different origins from astronomical ones. Meteorology as a term is perhaps not entirely misguided, since weather is indeed related to our position in the solar system, but of course very differently than originally conceived. Happily, despite meteorologists' earlier misunderstandings, the term meteor is no longer used in this way. We readily see meteors because the objects that created them heat up on entry and emit glowing material that we see as light, which appears in an arc because of the meteoroid's fast speed. Though many meteors happen randomly, meteor showers are more regular occurrences that arise from the Earth passing through comet debris. Of course, meteors are more readily observed at night, when the sun's light doesn't obscure them. There is no philosophical tree falling in the forest quandary here. The existence of meteors doesn't depend on observers actually looking. The streaks of light just have to be visible in principle. Most meteors arise from dust or pebble-sized objects. Millions of them enter our atmosphere daily. Since most meteoroids fall apart above 50 kilometers in altitude, meteors typically occur between about 75 and 100 kilometers above sea level and what is called the mesosphere. Though the precise speed depends on an object's specific properties and its alignment of the velocity with respect to the Earth, the speeds of the objects creating the meteors are generally on the order of tens of kilometers per second. The trajectory of a meteor helps identify where the meteoroid that created it came from, whereas the spectrum of visible light a meteor emits and its influence on radio signals both help scientists determine a meteoroid's composition. The meteoroids that make it through the atmosphere and hit the Earth can lead to meteorites. Meteorites are the rocks left on Earth after an extraterrestrial object is hit, decomposed, melted, and partially vaporized. Meteorites are yet another tangible reminder that the Earth is intrinsically part of a cosmic environment. You might be lucky and find a meteorite in the vicinity of a meteoroid impact, but you are more likely to see them in laboratories, museums, or the houses of sufficiently obsessive, lucky, or wealthy people. The Vatican Observatory Museum has quite a nice collection, as does the Smithsonian's American Museum of Natural History, which contains the largest one. A 3-star general told me that the Department of Defense has a nice assortment, too. Their collection is connected to missile defense, but unfortunately, their data on meteoroid impacts remain classified. The study of those meteorites that scientists can access has taught us a great deal about the solar system and its origins. Meteorites can also arise from comets, the objects of the outer solar system that feature in the following chapter. Objects that orbit in the inner solar system are different enough from the ones in the outer solar system that only the ones inside Jupiter's orbit are referred to as asteroids or minor planets, which, unlike asteroid, is the somewhat dismissive-sounding but official term. The distinction between comets and asteroids might seem obvious, the most striking difference being the comet's prominent tail. But the delineation is actually more nuanced. Comets generally have more elongated orbits, but some asteroids have similarly eccentric orbits too, probably because they were comets originally. Moreover, the water-containing asteroids are not necessarily a distinct population from the comet-forming populations of the outer solar system. This varied composition of asteroids also indicates that the population considered asteroids and the one considered comets have some overlap. The distinction is sufficiently blurry that in 2006, the International Astronomical Union devised the term small solar system body to encompass them both, but not dwarf planets. Dwarf planets could have been included as small solar system bodies too, but since they are much larger and more spherical, indicative of the stronger gravity that makes them more likely to be solid objects, the IAU chose to omit them from the category and distinguish them with their own name. In general, the IAU prefers the term small solar system body to minor planet, precisely because objects in the asteroid belt can sometimes have the characteristics of comet nuclei. A single term that encompasses them both, though less informative, prevents mistakes. Even so, asteroids are generally rockier, and comets usually contain more volatile substances, so most astronomers persist with the distinction. This awkward terminology leaves me in a quandary when in the rest of this book I refer to big objects that hit the Earth. Small objects that burn up in the sky are meteoroids or micrometeoroids. Bigger objects, which originate as either asteroids or comets, occasionally make it to the Earth or its atmosphere too, but we know which one only if we observe the trajectory and hence its origin. We need a term that can refer to either. The cumbersome term small solar system bodies technically fits the bill, but is rarely used for objects flying in from the sky, especially those that come close to or hit the Earth. Check the headlines and you will find meteor, meteoroid, or even meteorite frequently employed, even though technically they are all wrong if the object is bigger than a meter. Since there seems to be no common colloquial term that is sufficiently specific, though impactor and bolide are sometimes used, I will call the objects meteoroids, the least egregious of these offenses, throughout this book when referring to an extraterrestrial object that enters the atmosphere or that hits the Earth. This is a slight abuse of terminology in that the term usually refers only to a smaller object, but in context, it should be clear what I mean. Chapter 7. The Short Glorious Lives of Comets. If you ever have the opportunity to travel to the Italian city of Padua, be sure to visit the Scrovegni Chapel. This well-preserved gem from the early 14th century houses a magnificent fresco cycle by the early Renaissance artist Giotto. My favorite image, and the one that is treasured by all my physics colleagues there, is the Adoration of the Magi, reproduced in Figure 13 on the enhancement, which shows a comet conspicuously passing over the classic nativity scene. Perhaps, as the art historian Roberta Olson has suggested, the comet replaces the Star of David, the more familiar compositional element, with a bright, dramatic object that people had witnessed overhead only a few years before the painting was completed. Independent of the allegorical intention, the flash of light over the creche is unmistakably a comet, very likely Halley's Comet, which anyone in that part of the world would have seen. The enormous comet tail that extended over a significant part of the sky in September and October 1301 would have been a spectacular sight, especially in an era predating electric lights. I like to reflect on early 14th century Italians gazing upward and appreciating the same astrophysical wonders that we marvel at today. Evidence from ancient Greek and Chinese civilizations indicates that people had been observing and appreciating comets at least 2,000 years before that as well. Aristotle even tried to understand the nature of comets, interpreting them as phenomena in the upper atmosphere where dry, hot material would start to burn. We've come a long way since the time of the ancient Greeks. Scientists' more recent insights based on mathematics and far better observations have taught us that comets are cold, nothing is burning, and the volatile material they contain is readily converted to gaseous vapor or water once they get close enough to the sun. Now that we've explored the nature of asteroids, which come from relatively nearby in the solar system, let's move on to comets, which arise from distant domains known as the scattered disk, which overlaps the Kuiper belt, and the Oort cloud, which lies in the outer reaches of our solar system. Comets occur in other stellar systems as well, but our focus here will be on those we know best, the ones that originate in our own domain. Though we know now that comets arise from distant regions and only rarely follow paths that bring them close to Earth, Tycho Brahe's conclusion in the 16th century that comets reside outside the Earth's atmosphere was an important early milestone in scientific understanding. Tycho measured the parallax of the Great Comet of 1577 by integrating sightings from observers in different places, thereby determining that comets were at least four times as far away as the Moon. That's an understatement for sure, but it was a big leap forward at the time. Isaac Newton made another important deduction when he realized that comets move in oblique orbits. He demonstrated by using his gravitational inverse square law, which says the strength of gravity is four times smaller for an object twice as distant, that objects in the sky have to follow elliptical, parabolic, or hyperbolic orbits. When Newton fit the path of the Great Comet of 1680 to a parabola, he literally connected the dots, showing that the objects people had sighted and believed were different, in fact, fell along a single trajectory, the path of a single thing. Though the comet's trajectory is actually an elongated ellipse, the path was close enough to parabolic in shape that Newton's deduction of a single moving object remained correct. Early on, the first comets to be discovered were named after the year they appeared. In the early 20th century, the naming convention changed, and they became the namesake of the person who predicted the orbit, such as the German astronomer Johann Franz Encke and the German-Austrian military officer and amateur astronomer Wilhelm von Biele, both of whom have comets carrying their name. Though identified well before the 20th century, Halley's Comet too was named after the man who understood its trajectory sufficiently well to predict its recurrence. In 1705, using Newton's laws and taking into account perturbations by Jupiter and Saturn, Newton's friend and publisher Edmund Halley predicted that a comet that had already appeared in 1378, 1456, 1531, 1607, and 1682 would reappear in 1758-59. Halley was the first to suggest a comet's periodic motion, and he got it right. Three French mathematicians did even more precise calculations and predicted the 1759 date to within a month. We can do similar calculations today to determine that not before 2061 will someone on Earth witness Halley's comet again. Later in the 20th century, the convention changed again, converting to naming comets after the people who discovered them. And once comet discovery became a collective effort based on more advanced observational tools, comets were named for the instrument that found them. The current list contains about 5,000 comets, but a realistic estimate of their total number is at least 1,000 times greater and could be far bigger still, perhaps as high as a trillion. The nature of comets. Understanding the nature and composition of comets requires a little knowledge about the states of matter. The familiar phases of matter are solid, liquid, and gas, which for water amounts to ice, water, and steam. Atoms are arranged differently in each of the phases, with solid ice the most structured and gaseous vapor the most random. When a phase transition converts liquid into gas, as happens when water boils, for example, or solid into liquid, as occurs when ice cubes melt, the material stays the same, since all the same atoms and molecules are present, but the material's nature becomes very different. The form that matter takes, therefore, depends on its temperature and its composition, which determines the boiling and melting points for any particular stuff. I was amused to hear that someone recently took advantage of the different phases to try to bring a bottle of water past airport security. He froze it and argued that the solid ice in his bottle didn't defy any anti-liquid ban. Unfortunately, the Transportation Security Administration agent was not convinced. Had the representative been educated in physics, he might have compellingly argued that only substances that are solid under standard temperature and pressure are allowed. However, I'm pretty sure this isn't what was said. Note that temperature and physics both play a role, because melting and boiling points are different at different pressures, as anyone who has tried to make pasta in Aspen, Colorado, at 8,000 feet above sea level, would know. The melting and boiling points are critical to any structure, since they determine the phase that its material will take. Some elements, such as hydrogen and helium, have extremely low boiling and melting points. Helium becomes liquid, for example, only at 4 degrees above absolute zero. Planetary scientists call those elements with melting point below 100 degrees Kelvin gases, independent of the actual phase the matter is in. Those with low melting point but not so low as gases are referred to, again by planetary scientists, as ices, though whether or not the material is actually an ice also depends on the actual temperature. That is why Jupiter and Saturn are called gas giants, while Uranus and Neptune are sometimes called ice giants. In both cases, the interior is actually a hot, dense fluid. Gases, in the sense used by planetary scientists, are a subset of volatiles, which are elements and compounds with low boiling points, such as nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, sulfur dioxide, and water, that might be present in a planet or atmosphere. A material with low melting point will more readily turn into a gas. You might have seen ice cream made from cold liquid nitrogen. This is a staple of molecular cuisine in modern restaurants, as well as a standard science fair demonstration. It also featured in one of the food trucks outside Harvard's Science Center, which, fortunately for my health, usually made ice cream flavors I don't like. If you have seen any such example, you will have noticed how readily the nitrogen atoms escape as gas at room temperature, making the apparatus look very dramatic and a little like a caricature of a lab experiment. The Earth's moon is low in volatiles, since it consists mostly of silicates, with little in the way of hydrogen, nitrogen, or carbon. Comets, on the other hand, contain abundant volatiles, which is what gives rise to their dramatic tails. Comets originate well beyond Jupiter in the outer regions of the solar system, where water and methane remain cold and frozen. In these very cold regions far from the sun, ice doesn't turn to gas. Ice remains ice. Only when comets pass into the inner solar system, where they are closer to the heat of the sun, do the volatile materials in the comet vaporize so that they stream out along with some dust, creating an atmosphere around the nucleus called the coma. The coma can be much bigger than the nucleus, thousands or even millions of kilometers across, sometimes becoming larger even than the sun. Bigger dust particles remain in the coma, whereas lighter ones are pushed into the tail by the sun's radiation and charged particle emissions. A comet consists of the coma, the nucleus it surrounds, and the tail that streams away. Meteor showers, which arise out of the solid debris that comets leave in their wake, are spectacular evidence of comets. They occur after a comet has crossed the Earth's orbit, so that some of the discarded material lies along the Earth's path. The Earth then passes through the debris on a regular basis, creating the wonderful periodic meteor showers that are so remarkable to see. Comet Swift-Tuttle's debris is the origin of the Perseid meteor shower, which occurs in early August, and that I've unwittingly encountered in the clear skies of Aspen, where a physics center hosts summer workshops. Another example is the Orion meteor shower, which occurs in October and arose from the scattered fragments of Halley's Comet. Comets are among the most spectacular objects we can witness overhead with the naked eye. Most are very faint, but ones such as Halley's, which are visible without a telescope, pass by perhaps a few times a decade. Comets orbit the sun with bright ion tails and separate dust tails that generally point in different directions. These trails of brightly shining dust and gas are the origin of their name, which comes from a Greek word that translates as wearing long hair. Whereas the dust tail generally follows the comet's path, the ion tail points away from the sun. The ion tail forms when solar ultraviolet radiation hits the coma, tearing off electrons from some of the atoms there. The ionized particles create a magnetic field and what is known as a magnetosphere. Something called the solar wind plays an important role in this manifestation of comets. Everyone is familiar with the sun's radiation, which gives rise to the photons we experience as heat and light on Earth. Less well known are the charged particles, electrons and protons, that the sun emits and that make up the solar wind. When in the 1950s the German scientist Ludwig Biermann, and independently another German, Paul Ahnert, made the extraordinary observation that the bright ion tail of a comet always points away from the sun, Biermann proposed that the sun emits particles that push on the comet tail, making it point this way. In a metaphorical sense, the solar wind blew the ion tail there. Understanding this process taught scientists about both comets and the sun, and enlightened me as to the origin of the mysterious name. Comet tails can extend up to tens of millions of kilometers. The sizes of comet nuclei are, of course, much smaller, but still pretty big compared to a typical asteroid. The nuclei don't have sufficient gravity to round out their structure, so they have irregular shapes, varying in size from a few hundred meters to tens of kilometers across. That might be observational bias, since bigger ones are easier to spot, but searches employing sufficiently sensitive instruments to find smaller objects have so far come up empty-handed. In terms of visibility, it's a good thing that comets have comas and tails. Comet nuclei are very non-reflective, which makes them extraordinarily difficult to see, since the most common way to view non-burning objects, such as you and me, is through reflected light. To mention one well-known example, the nucleus of Halley's comet reflects only about 1/25th of the light that hits it. This is comparable to the reflectivity of asphalt or charcoal, which we know to be very dark. Other comet nuclei reflect even less. In fact, comet surfaces seem to be the darkest ones in the solar system. Whereas the more volatile, lighter compounds are removed by the heat of the sun, the darker, larger organic compounds remain. The dark materials absorb light, heating the ices that send out gases to become the tails. The similarity in reflectivity between charcoal and comets would then not be coincidental. Remember that tar is also made from large organic molecules, namely those in petroleum. Now imagine asphalt in the sky billions of kilometers away. Without a lot of effort devoted to seeking it out, such a dark object would indeed be lost in obscurity. When comets are in the outer solar system, they are dark and frozen with just the faintest of optical emissions. The only way to observe comets before they approach the sun is through the infrared light they emit. Not until they get to the inner solar system do the coma and tail form to make comets more readily visible. Dust then reflects sunlight, and the ions make the gases glow, leading to light we can more readily observe. Even so, most comets are visible only with a telescope. The exact chemical makeup of comets is even harder to observe than the objects themselves. Meteorites found on Earth give us some clues by conveying some of their actual material to our home turf. Scientists have also noted the various colors of comets and observed some of their spectral lines. Using these and other sparse clues, scientists have concluded that the nucleus consists of water ice, dust, pebble-like rocks, and frozen gases including carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, methane, and ammonia. Nuclei surfaces appear to be rocky, with ice buried a little below the surface. Given the limited astronomical observations of his time, Isaac Newton gave a remarkably accurate interpretation of comets in the 17th century. He mistakenly thought they were compact, durable, solid bodies, but he recognized that the tails were thin streams of vapor that had been heated by the sun. In terms of understanding the composition of comets, the philosopher Immanuel Kant in 1755 did an even better job. He surmised that comets were composed of volatile material that vaporizes to create the tail. In the 1950s, Fred Whipple of the Harvard Astronomy Department, and a discoverer of six comets himself, famously recognized the preponderance of ice in comets, with dust and rock only secondary, giving rise to the dirty snowball model you might have heard about. In fact, the composition isn't entirely settled, and some are dirtier than others, but better observations are still advancing our knowledge. One further fascinating compositional feature of a comet is that it contains organic compounds, such as methanol, hydrogen cyanide, formaldehyde, ethanol, and ethane, as well as long-chain hydrocarbons and amino acids, the precursors of life. Meteorites on Earth have even been found to contain components of DNA and RNA that presumably came from either asteroids or comets. Objects that carry water and amino acids and hit the Earth on a regular basis are certainly worthy of our attention. Comets' fascinating structure and possible relevance to life have made them an obvious target for a number of space missions. The first spacecraft studying comets flew by their tails and the surfaces of their nuclei to collect and analyze dust particles and perhaps take photographs, but without the proximity or resolution to provide significant detail. In 1985, the International Cometary Explorer, a redirected mission of NASA with some European support, was the first spacecraft to approach the tail of a comet, but from only 3,000 kilometers away. The Halley Armada, consisting of the two Russian-launched Vega missions, Japan's Suisei mission, and the European Giotto spacecraft, followed soon afterward to try to better study the comet's nucleus and coma. But the Giotto robotic mission, named for the painter of the comet illustrating Adoration of the Magi, mentioned earlier, surpassed them all. This spacecraft approached the nucleus of Halley's comet within 600 kilometers, more than 10 times closer than the previous missions. More recent missions, which have tried to directly explore comets and their composition, have done even better. The Stardust spacecraft collected and analyzed dust particles from the coma of the comet Wild 2 in early 2004 and brought this material to Earth for study in 2006. The comet's material did not consist primarily of interstellar medium material as expected for an object formed in the distant Oort cloud, but was instead mostly stuff heated from within the solar system. Scientists showed that the comet contained minerals of iron and copper sulfide, which couldn't have formed without liquid water, implying that the comet must have initially been warmer and therefore must have formed closer to the sun. The results furthermore demonstrated that the composition of comets and asteroids is not always as different as scientists had expected. And Deep Impact is not just an ambitious, if somewhat confused, movie. It is also the name of a space probe that in 2005 sent an impactor into Comet Tempel 1. The spacecraft was designed to study the comet interior and photograph the impact crater, though the dust cloud that the impact created somewhat obscured the images. The discovery of crystalline material, which requires much more extreme temperatures to form than comets currently experience, indicated either that material entered the comet from the inner solar system or that the comet initially formed in a region distant from its current location. More recent probes of comets are more exciting still. In a remarkable development, the European Space Agency in 2004 launched a spacecraft named Rosetta to orbit the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko and subsequently land an even more direct probe named Philae onto its surface to study the nucleus composition and inner regions up close. One of the major news stories of November 2014 featured Philae, which landed, but not as smoothly as planned, with bounces sending it to a less stable location. The event, which was quite literally a cliffhanger, has accomplished a fair fraction of its scientific goals. Though the drill mission didn't succeed, Philae, even in the wrong place and without the intended attachment mechanisms in place, has studied a comet's shape and atmosphere in more detail than ever before. Rosetta now orbits the comet and will continue to do so as it enters the inner solar system. This entire mission is already a rather spectacular accomplishment, perhaps more impressive in light of its launch happening within a century of the Wright brothers' launch of their first plane. Short and long period comets. Yet even with all the progress, many intriguing questions about comets remain. In addition to better determining what they are made of, astronomers would like to deepen their understanding of both the orbit of comets and the manner in which comets are formed. In fact, we don't necessarily expect a single unified explanation, since there is evidence for distinct classes of comets, distinguished as short period and long period type, according to the time it takes for them to complete their journey around the sun. The demarcation between short and long periods is taken to be 200 years, but periods vary overall from a few years to several million. Comets originate beyond Neptune, and the reservoir of these trans-Neptunian objects resides in distinct orbital bands located at different distances from the sun. The inner regions, which give rise to short-period comets, are called the Kuiper Belt and the Scattered Disk, while much farther out is the hypothesized Oort cloud, which produces long-period comets, and to which I'll soon, figuratively, return. An additional region that astrophysicists propose, but that we will not focus on here, lies between the scattered disk and the Oort cloud, and is given the patronizing-sounding name detached objects. To a large extent, the categorization of the inner and outer regions from which comets originated overlaps with their orbital period. The comets we see most often are short-period comets, such as Halley's Comet, which recurs at manageable intervals and which generations of humans have observed. Short-period comets come from closer-in regions, and long-period comets mostly arrive from farther out. We occasionally see long-period comets, too, but only if and when they enter the inner solar system, which might be caused by perturbations to the distant Oort cloud. The sun's gravity binds the comets there only weakly, so that even small disturbances can send objects out of their orbits, plunging inward toward the sun. Even short-period comets, such as Halley's Comet, might have first been kicked out of a more distant long-period orbit into a shorter-period one in the inner solar system. Short-period breaks down into two subcategories: Halley family comets, with periods greater than 20 years, and Jupiter family comets, with smaller periods. There are likely some asteroids or dormant, extinct comets on short-period orbits too, but probably extremely few asteroids have an orbital period greater than 20 years. Longer-period comets are more eccentric, meaning they have more elongated orbits than shorter-period ones. This makes sense, since comets are visible to us only near the sun. Whereas short-period comets circle closer into the sun's vicinity, a comet that is both observable and has a long period should have an orbit that dips inward close to the sun, but then extends far outward to create the long path that requires a long time to travel around. The orbits of long-period comets also seem to lie closer to the ecliptic plane in which the planets travel, and furthermore orbit in the same general direction. The fate of any of these objects, once they have entered the inner solar system, depends on possible further perturbations. Jupiter is the biggest known relatively local perturber, since its mass is more than double the total mass of all the other planets combined. New comets in the inner solar system might enter a new orbit, or they might appear only once before getting kicked out of the solar system or colliding with a planet, as Shoemaker-Levy famously and gloriously did when it crashed into Jupiter not so long ago, in 1994. The Kuiper Belt and the Scattered Disk. Let's now consider the domains that contain the icy minor solar system bodies that will turn into comets if perturbed to enter the inner solar system. Our first subject will be the Kuiper Belt. Figure 14 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook contains a graphic. Take a look. Though not itself the reservoir of short-period comets, it is an important guidepost to the scattered disk, which is. To me, one of the most interesting aspects of the Kuiper Belt, which was predicted in the 1940s and 1950s, is the recentness of its discovery. No further back than 1992, astronomers determined that our understanding of the solar system, which many of us learned in grade school and thought to be on very solid footing, had to be revised to account for the discovery of the Kuiper Belt and several other advances I'll soon discuss. Even if you've never heard of the Kuiper Belt, you might be familiar with a few objects that reside in or originated there. These include three dwarf planets, among them the former planet known as Pluto. Though now located far from the Kuiper Belt, Neptune's moon Triton and Saturn's moon Phoebe also have sizes and compositions indicating they too began their existence in this locale before planetary transits pulled them away. An AU, or astronomical unit, is about 150 million kilometers, the approximate distance between the Earth and the Sun. The Kuiper Belt lies in a region roughly 30 times as far from the Sun, between about 30 and 55 AU away. It contains a large number of minor planets, most of which are situated in the classical Kuiper Belt, which lies between about 42 and 48 AU from the Sun. This region extends vertically about 10 degrees outside the ecliptic plane, though the mean position has only a couple of degrees inclination. Its thickness makes it more donut-shaped than belt-shaped. Even so, its slightly misleading name survives. The name is a bit unfair for another reason, too. The number and variety of prior speculations on the nature of the Kuiper Belt makes it unclear who precisely deserves credit for the proposal. Soon after its discovery in the 1920s, many astronomers suspected that Pluto was not alone. As early as 1930, scientists introduced various hypotheses about additional trans-Neptunian objects, but the astronomer Kenneth Edgeworth probably deserves the most credit. In 1943, he argued that the material in the early solar system in the region beyond Neptune was too diffuse to create planets and would instead become a group of smaller bodies. He continued to speculate that on occasion one of these objects would enter the inner solar system to become a comet. Scientists now favor a scenario very similar to Edgeworth's, whereby the early solar disk condensed into objects smaller than planets, sometimes known as planetesimals. Gerard Kuiper, for whom the Kuiper Belt is named, made his hypothesis later, in 1951, and furthermore didn't quite get it right, thinking it to be a transient structure that would have disappeared by today, since he thought Pluto was bigger than it actually is, and would therefore have cleared the local region as other planets have done. Because Pluto is considerably smaller than Kuiper anticipated, this didn't happen, so the Kuiper Belt, with its many objects in the same general region as Pluto's orbit, has indeed survived. Edgeworth is sometimes credited along with Kuiper for his speculation through the name Edgeworth-Kuiper Belt. But, as almost always happens with elongated names, in America at least, the shorter form is more commonly used. As with the Sverius Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, which was created as an afterthought to the true Nobel Prizes, but is usually referred to as the Nobel Prize in Economics rather than by its full and more cumbersome name, you rarely hear the longer version of the astronomical term that appropriately recognizes Edgeworth's contribution. Following Edgeworth's and Kuiper's suggestions, scientists realized that comets themselves clue us into the Kuiper Belt's existence. There were too many short-period comets discovered in the 1970s to be accounted for by the Oort cloud, the much more distant reservoir of comets that we will turn to soon. Short-period comets arose near the plane of the solar system, as opposed to Oort cloud comets, which were far more spherically distributed around the sun. Based on this evaluation, the Uruguayan astronomer Julio Fernandez thought the comets could be explained instead by a belt located in the region where we now know the Kuiper Belt to be. As always, despite all these speculations, discovery required the necessary observational sensitivity. Because finding small, distant, non-luminous objects is not easy, the first objects, aside from Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, were discovered only in 1992 and early 1993. Jane Liu and David Jewett, who started their search when Jewett was a professor at MIT and Liu was a student, conducted their observations at the Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona and the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. They continued after Jewett had moved to the University of Hawaii, where they could use the university's 2.24-meter telescope on the summit of the now-dormant volcano Mauna Kea, a beautiful viewing site with wonderfully clear skies, well worth visiting if you are on the Big Island. After 5 years of searching, they discovered two Kuiper Belt objects, the first in the summer of 1992 and the other early in the following year. Since then, many other such objects have been discovered, though they almost certainly represent only a tiny fraction of what exists. We now know the belt contains more than 1,000 residents, which are known as Kuiper Belt objects, or KBOs, though calculations argue that as many as 100,000, with diameters greater than 100 kilometers, could be out there. It is worth noting that despite Pluto's loss of planetary status, it is still special, which is why it was discovered before any other object in the Kuiper Belt. Based on what we now know about the masses of objects in its vicinity, Pluto is larger than would be expected. This one object seems to carry a few percent of the total mass of the Kuiper Belt, and is very likely the largest such object there. In fact, the Kuiper Belt's low net mass is an interesting clue to its origin. Although estimates range from about 4 to 10% of the Earth's mass, solar system formation models would assign the Kuiper Belt more like 30 times the mass of the Earth. If its mass had always been so low, no object greater than 100 kilometers in diameter would have joined the belt, which is contradicted by Pluto's existence. This tells us that a large fraction, more than 99% of the predicted mass, isn't there. Either KBOs formed elsewhere, closer to the sun, or something dispersed most of the mass. The many other objects that have a similar orbit to Pluto are called Plutinos, and are located a little less than 40 AUs from the sun, though their highly eccentric orbits mean their distances vary. Plutinos are resonant Kuiper Belt objects, which are those that travel in orbits that have a fixed ratio with respect to Neptune. Plutinos, for example, orbit the Sun twice during the time Neptune makes three trips around. The fixed ratio prevents the objects from getting too close to Neptune, and so they escape its stronger gravitational field that would otherwise kick them out of the region. Amusingly, the International Astronomical Union, IAU, requires that Plutinos, like Pluto, have also to be named after underworld deities. We know of at least 1,000 such objects, though given the limited surveys to date, scientists suspect, as with the other categories I've discussed, the existence of far more. However, the dominant Kuiper Belt population does not consist of Plutinos, but of objects that lie in the classical Kuiper Belt. Surveys have found many such objects, and the Pan-STARRS survey project, which is now searching full-time for anything in the solar system that visibly moves, will very likely find many more. The objects in the classical Kuiper Belt have stable orbits that aren't disturbed by Neptune, even without any resonant orbit that keeps it a fixed distance away. A good fraction of these redder classical objects have very circular orbits. A second population has more eccentric and more inclined orbits, up to a maximum of about 30 degrees, but typically far less. This leaves some relatively unpopulated, unstable regions within the Kuiper Belt, containing only those objects that have arrived fairly recently. Objects that used to be in the Kuiper Belt are likely precursors, or at least related to many of the comets we observe, so it shouldn't be surprising that their composition is essentially that of comets. They are mostly made of ices of materials such as methane, ammonia, and water. The presence of ice rather than gas is due to the location of the belt and its consequent low temperature of about 50 degrees Kelvin, more than 200 degrees colder than the freezing point of water. After scientists finish analyzing data from the New Horizons spacecraft, which will have gathered a lot of information about Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, we should learn a good deal more. The orbits in the belt are stable, however, so comets don't originate precisely there. Kuiper Belt permanent residents won't make their way to the Sun. Instead, short-period comets arise from the scattered disk, a relatively empty region containing icy minor planets that overlaps with the Kuiper Belt but extends much farther from the Sun, to 100 AU or more. The scattered disk contains objects whose orbits can be destabilized by Neptune. The greater eccentricity, range of locations, and degree of inclinations, up to about 30 degrees, distinguish the scattered disk population from that of Kuiper Belt objects, as does their instability. Scattered disk objects have medium to high eccentricity, meaning they have stretched out rather than circular orbits. Their eccentricity is so high that even objects whose maximum range is far away from Neptune get close enough during their orbits to be subject to Neptune's gravitational field. This is why the influence of Neptune can sometimes send scattered disk objects into the inner solar system, where they get warmed up to release gas and dust and thereby become recognizable as comets. Eris, the one known minor planet comparable in size to Pluto, lies outside the Kuiper Belt in the scattered disk, and was the first one there to be identified. To find it, astronomers on Mauna Kea used charge-coupled devices, an advanced version of the technology used in digital cameras, along with better computer processing. These made more distant objects possible to observe and contributed to Eris's quite recent 1996 discovery. Astronomers found three more scattered disk objects a few years later. Another one, the unpoetically named 48639-1995-TL, was discovered earlier, in 1995, but was only later classified as an object in the scattered disk. Hundreds more have been discovered since then. Their total number is probably comparable to that of Kuiper Belt objects, but being farther away, they are more challenging to observe. Kuiper Belt objects and scattered disk objects contain similar compounds. Like other trans-Neptunian objects, the objects in the scattered disk have low density and are composed primarily of frozen volatiles such as water and methane. Many think that Kuiper Belt objects and scattered disk objects started off in the same region, but gravitational interactions, primarily with Neptune, sent some into stable orbits in the Kuiper Belt and others inward into a region containing objects called centaurs, which lies between the orbits of Jupiter and Neptune. Gravitational interactions sent the remaining objects into the unstable orbits of the scattered disk. The gravitational influence of the outer planets is almost certainly responsible for much of the structure of the Kuiper Belt and the scattered disk. It appears that at some point, Jupiter drifted inward toward the center of the solar system, while Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune moved outward. Jupiter and Saturn used each other to stabilize their orbits. Jupiter orbits the Sun exactly twice as fast as Saturn. But these planets destabilized Uranus and Neptune, putting them into different orbits, with Neptune becoming more eccentric and orbiting farther out. En route to its final destination, Neptune likely scattered many planetesimals into more eccentric orbits and many others into more inner orbits where they would rescatter or get ejected by Jupiter's influence. This would have left less than 1% of the Kuiper Belt intact, while the majority would have scattered away. A competing proposal is that the Kuiper Belt formed first and the scattered objects came from the Kuiper Belt. In this proposal, similar in many respects to the one above, Neptune and the outer planets scattered some objects into eccentric and inclined orbits, either toward the inner solar region or outward into farther reaches of the solar system. Some of the objects scattered from the Kuiper Belt outward would then have become scattered disk objects. Others might have become centaurs. This would solve the mystery of how the centaurs, which have unstable orbits and can stay in their domain only a few million years, can exist to this day. The Kuiper Belt might replenish them. Comets, too, have only finite but glorious lifetimes. The sun's heat gradually erodes them by sublimating their volatile surfaces. Without a continuous source of new objects, comets would no longer be around. The Oort cloud. The scattered disk is the reservoir of short-period comets. The Oort cloud, an enormous, spherically distributed cloud of icy planetesimals containing perhaps a trillion minor planets, is the hypothesized source of long-period ones. An illustration of the Oort cloud appears in Figure 15 on the enhancement. The Oort cloud is named after the Dutch astronomer Jan Hendrik Oort, who has several significant achievements to his credit, with at least two physics terms bearing his name. One of Oort's most notable achievements involved establishing in 1932 how to observationally measure the amount of matter, including dark matter, in the galaxy. Oort is also responsible for the speculation about what is now called the Oort cloud. In the 1930s, the Estonian astronomer Ernst Julius Opik first suggested such a cloud's existence as the place where long-period comets originate. By 1950, Oort had both theoretical and empirical reasons to conjecture about such a spherical cloud of very distant objects. First, he observed that the long-period comets that were coming from all directions had extremely large orbits, indicating an origin much farther out than the Kuiper Belt. Oort further realized that comet orbits couldn't have survived long enough to be observed today had they always been in their current paths. Comet orbits are unstable, so planetary perturbations cause them eventually to collide with the Sun or a planet or to be sent out of the solar system altogether. Furthermore, comets run out of steam by passing close to the Sun too many times. The outgassing can't last forever before the objects disappear. Oort's hypothesis was that what we now call the Oort cloud replenishes the supply of fresh comets so newer ones can still be observed today. The proposed distance of the Oort cloud is enormous. The Earth's distance from the Sun is 1 AU, and that of Neptune, the most distant planet, is 30 AU. Astronomers think the Oort cloud extends from perhaps as close as 1,000 AU from the Sun to distances farther than 50,000 AU, significantly farther than anything we have so far considered. The Oort cloud reaches a good fraction of the distance from the Sun to the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, about 270,000 AU, or 4.2 light-years away. Light from the Oort cloud would take almost a year to get to us. The weak gravitational binding energy of objects at the distant edge of the solar system explains why they would be vulnerable to small gravitational perturbations that can give rise to the comets we observe. Nudges can kick them out of their orbits into the inner solar system, giving rise to long-period comets. Perturbations of these weakly bound objects might lead to short-period comets, too, when a planet further diverts their inward trajectories. So the Oort cloud is probably responsible for all long-period comets, such as the recently observed comet Hale-Bopp, and even some short-period ones, Halley's Comet, perhaps among them. Moreover, even though most Jupiter-family short-period comets probably come from the scattered disk, some of them contain isotope ratios of carbon and nitrogen that are similar to those of the long-period comets from the Oort cloud, indicating an origin there, too. A final and even more disruptive possibility is that objects perturbed from the Oort cloud could enter the inner solar system and collide with a planet, possibly the Earth, to create a comet strike. Later on, I will return to this intriguing